deliberation and decision of these cases. There are three causes that will be, well, first let me announce that the orders of the court are posted outside and in the clerk's office and are available for your inspection and are hereby pronounced. We have three causes for oral submission this morning. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Laura Homer Chapa and others versus the Honorable Ricardo H. Garcia, judge on original mandamus proceeding. Mildred Cecil versus Charles Madison Smith from Henderson County, and Martha Jean Phillips versus Harry S. Phillips and others from Smith County. We have allotted slightly different times for argument in each of these causes, and I will announce that prior to the argument. Counsel in the second and third causes do not have to remain in the courtroom while earlier arguments are being presented, but we ask that you remain nearby so that we may proceed to your matter without delay in the event that a cause finishes early. We will complete the argument of all three of these causes before lunch, but we will take brief recesses in between the presentations of each. And these arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. You may listen to the tapes of these arguments by making application with the clerk of our court. In the original mandamus proceeding, Chapa versus Garcia, the court has allotted 25 minutes for each side to present oral argument and 5 minutes for relators to present rebuttal. The court is now ready to hear oral argument from relators.
May it please the court, Mr. Robert A. Chapin will present argument for the relators.
Morning, gentlemen. May it please the court. The day before Christmas Eve in 1984, 13-year-old Louise Chapa was going hunting. Deer hunting in South Texas with his two favorite uncles, Uncle Eddie and Uncle Romeo. They got to the ranch of his uncle and his grandfather where they were hunting, made camp and prepared to go hunting. They drove to the spot where the hunt was to begin and got out of the truck. At this point, Uncle Eddie, a man with some 30 years experience with high-powered rifles, got his Remington Model 700 and prepared to load it. He grasped the bolt hands. First, he was forced to move the safety from the safe to the fire position, which we allege to be the first design defect found in the Model 700. After he placed the gun in the fire position, he grasped the handle of the bolt and moved a cartridge from the magazine to the chamber. And as he closed the bolt, with his hand nowhere near the trigger, the gun suddenly and unexpectedly fired and violently blew apart the back of his nephew's left leg. The second defect in the gun is the design of the fire control, which allows it to fire without the trigger being pulled. Louise Chapa was lucky that day. There was a combat veteran from Vietnam present, a friend of his uncle's, who applied a tourniquet to the leg, stopped the bleeding, and after a 100-mile-an-hour trip to the hospital, the boy's life was saved. Soon after that, his father heard stories from his neighbors and friends of other Model 700s that had the same problem. A lawsuit was filed. We quickly discovered that the Model 700 had been involved in over 50 different lawsuits over the years, and hundreds, if not thousands, of complaints had been lodged with Remington Arms involving the misfire of this rifle. We formed a sharing agreement with other plaintiffs' counsel around the country who also handled these suits, particularly Mr. Joe Longley here in Austin, who was representing the plaintiff in Remington versus Craig, or Craig versus Remington. We quickly filed our first request for productions and described with reasonable particularity, as required by Rule 167C, that we wanted all new, different, alternative, replacement designs, as well as all studies, meetings, and minutes of any sort dealing with these designs. Remington responded by failing to mention trade secret whatsoever. No claim of trade secret privilege was made. A waiver under Rule 166B4 occurred at that time. Alternate design documents in products liability cases are discoverable to prove defect, feasibility, both scientifically and economically, of a safer, more effective design. We sought the documents for that reason.
Well, now, at that point, the NBAR documents were not referred to in the discovery, I take it.
Yes, sir. NBAR, and I will show you.
Your position is that if a party thinks that documents are not called for by request for production, and therefore does not raise a privilege to them, that they've waived the privilege.
Better than that, Your Honor. Even on the Groucho Marx show, for Say the Magic Word, we would have won, because NBAR, on the very face of the NBAR documents, is called a replacement for the Model 700, In request number 71, we asked for all replacement designs for the Model 700. So we rung the bell, Your Honor, and still they did not disclose the existence of the design.
But so I understand your position, it is that if a party does not believe that documents are within the scope of those requested to be produced, and therefore does not raise a privilege, if that question is later resolved adversely to the party, he's waived his privilege.
That's not my position, Your Honor. My position is that if you describe the documents with reasonable particularity as required by Rule 167C, and if you ask by name for the exact document, and if the party knows what you're looking for and doesn't disclose it, then yes, they have waived all privileges they ever had. And that's the facts that are in this case, Your Honor. Not that they didn't know what we were looking for. We described it by the exact name in our request for production.
And that name was replacement?
Replacement for the Model 700 found in our request for production. I brought the exhibit to show you that there's no confusion on this point. This is a new FAR document referred to as a replacement for the Model 700. The name replacement itself appears in our request for production. Even if we hadn't said the name replacement, though, Your Honor, Model 700 is written on the front of the document. The program is referred to as a replacement for the Model 700. We asked for these documents in at least 10 or 12 different manners. One of the key ways the plaintiff knows if he's asked for the right documents is he's got the name of the case written on the front of it. Now, the internal documents of the research department of a defendant in a products liability case oftentimes form the best and only source of evidence for the plaintiff in one of these cases. The real position that Remington espoused here was that these things were not really similar enough to be discovered. That's not true, but Jampo disposes of that argument by saying that similarity, adaptability, and feasibility are questions for the trier of fact, for the jury to make, not for the defendant to make. That has been the law, and Jampo lays it out in black and white language. Design differences between vehicles that might prevent certain alternatives from being adapted do not necessarily undermine the relevance or discoverability of the documents relating to those alternatives.
How do you respond to the argument that Jampo is distinguishable from this case because in Jampo, the items that were requested had been produced and were marketable, and the items you're requesting have neither been produced nor are marketable?
Jampo responds to that argument for you, Your Honor, in the rehearing written by Justice Speer. Jampo expresses concern that the court's opinion is unclear as to whether he is entitled to certain documents sought but for which mandamus does not lie. The documents are those relating to experimental, prototype, and pre-production crash testing. In a unanimous opinion, this court said, quote, we view all the requested documents as discoverable. Besides that, Your Honor, I will show you. This is a 1985 minute. This is a 1978 involving the exact same subject. Everything says this is different. It's new. The operations committee is the same as the firearm business committee. They simply changed the name after Remington was acquired 100% by DuPont. But look here. On February the 15th of 1978, they're seeking to develop improvements to the Model 700 fire control. In fact, they knew fire control. In other words, replacement. Here, they disclosed this document, Your Honor. Originally, this document in my request for production was denied to exist. Only after Judge Neil Caldwell in the Craig case sanctioned Remington $25,000 and held, and I quote, bad faith abuse of the discovery process was this document disclosed. After its disclosure, they were sanctioned in the Chapel case for withholding. But let's look at the similarity between NBAR and between program which they admit was discoverable as an improvement to the Model 700. They're both improvements. Here's the word, improvements. Improvements. They're both working to develop a preset engagement and over travel. Same thing here. Sear engagement and trigger travel determined by design. This is one of the main problems with the Model 700. It has too many little screws that the customer or gunsmith adjusts or gets out of adjustment, causing the gun to misfire. Here they have a customer adjustable trigger pull to a safe lower limit. 85 is the same thing they're working on here in 1978. Trigger externally adjustable for a pound pull within safe limits. Programs in 75 and 85 are obviously working toward the same goal. They're obviously both building prototypes, Your Honor. So we have established and proven, it's a question for the jury now to determine, just as they attempted to conceal this document, not only were they sanctioned in Craig, sanctioned in Chopper, but in the case in Illinois, it's called Seedberg versus Remington, they were sanctioned when this document was shared with counsel in that case for purposely abusing the discovery process. So there was an effort over 2 years to hide this document. It was only produced after Remington was forced to disclose the original documents. Remington originally produced copies of these documents and redacted or erased everything that had to do with the Model 700 fire control program. So we caught them once here. On October the 9th of 1990, they handed me 7 boxes full of materials. The boxes had obviously been ransacked. But in the back of one file lay this document. I hand copied. I said to Mr. Ware, make a copy of this document and give it to me. He left the room and I never have seen the original document since. But I preserved it, I filed an affidavit for it, and it's a key. What you can see from the NBAR program, Your Honors, is, which is exactly what JAMPO holds, is that the plaintiff, through discovery of this program, can actually prove the availability, technical and scientific capability to design and institute a new product prior to the date when the rifle made the basis of this lawsuit was manufactured and do away with all the damage. At the least, we can prove now that they have learned of defects in the Model 700 for which an inexcusable failure to warn was. We say even further that what we're talking about here, Your Honors, are documents that will lead us to evidence the nature of which was found in Ford Motor versus the Pinto cases, the Park to Reverse cases, other cases of that nature, where actual documents are disclosed that deal with the defendant's ability, capability, and knowledge and notice to make changes, yet those changes have not been made. That is the type of evidence that we seek in this case, Your Honor, for which we are denied. Not only did we ask for it in 1987, in 1989, after we learned of the existence of the program to improve the Model 700, we filed a second set of requests for production. By this time, everybody in Duval County knew what we were looking for. Again, we asked for the documents in 6 different ways, and again, Remington was silent. No trade secret privilege asserted. A second waiver occurred. A second time the waiver occurred. Now, still, only after weeks of searching through boxes were we able to discover in excess of 20 depositions of their people the existence of the program. We say to the court that discovery in Texas cases is not an appearance on the old Groucho Hill marks, you bet your life, sir. You do not have to say the magic word even. If the defendant knows what you're looking for, if you describe it with reasonable particularity as the rule calls for, you've got to come forward and make your objection or it's forever waived. Now, when Remington did get around to making their objections, they filed a motion to protection. But the only evidence they submitted in support of their trade secret claim, absent the documents themselves, was a secret affidavit, Your Honors. In my personal opinion, a disgusting ex-party communication with the court. Someone in their office messed up and mailed it to me when they filed their brief. It's a very interesting affidavit. Not because it contains any secrets, though. It's nothing more than a blatant ex-party communication with the court, which the Chief Justice himself and Justice Mousey in Barnes versus Whittington specifically said, we cannot consider ex-party affidavits submitted with in-camera documents strictly to buttress the claim of privilege here, which is what was done here. But the document doesn't contain any secrets. It doesn't talk about patents. It doesn't talk about trademarks. It doesn't talk about copyrights. Those things are never mentioned. The document is nothing more than an attempt to sway the trial court. 3 different hearings I held in Duval County in front of Judge Garcia until he finally told me not to come back. But he would not rule on my motion for months. The last time I appeared on November the 19th of 1989, I said, please give me that secret affidavit. He retained it over my objection. And then in his order, his written order of 723, he specifically referred to it and said he had relied on it. But let's see exactly what the secret affidavit says, which I do not believe we can ignore, Your Honor. It says, these documents, page 8, reflect Remington's actual and prospective ability to produce new designs. Actual and prospective ability to produce new designs. Their claim, we know it's so new, it's so different, It could never be used before, but we know from these documents the concept existed before. And state of the art, if that's their claim, you have to put on scientific evidence to show that you have some new invention that, that would qualify you for state of the art. That's a jury question, too. They're not entitled to conceal the documents. The real position of Remington here is, Your Honor, they say, oh, we're in great fear. Fear that these documents will fall into the hands of our competitors if you give them to the lawyers and to the experts. Well, the lawyers, being myself and Mr. Richard Miller, who is my co-counsel in this case, we signed a protective order that allows us to share these documents drafted by Remington with other plaintiffs' counsel. Now, the documents that we have discovered have resulted in 4 sanctions orders against Remington. That's true. No document has been disclosed to a competitor. Neither Mr. Miller or I has ever been sanctioned for any sort of discovery abuse.
It is also urged in connection with that claim that your experts work for the Remington competitors and that this information will get directly to Remington's competitors.
No evidence of that, Your Honor. I read you Mr. Lee Ware's affidavit. Dr. Rao occasionally testifies in cases involving Ruger. The affidavit, first off, Dr. Rao is not the plaintiff's expert in this case. Occasionally testifies in cases involving Ruger. It's not a sworn pleading that this man is dishonest that will turn the documents over to the competition. It is not even proof that he is presently or has ever been directly retained by any competitor. Occasionally testifies in cases involving Ruger. That is their sole proof on that issue, Your Honor. This man is employed by Failure Analysis Associates in California, probably the most reputable group of expert witnesses in the country. Are we to have conjecture and speculation here that this man will sell the documents at risk of his own personal freedom to a competitor of Remington's? Is that the type of speculation and conjecture that we must get down to here? I refer you to the case of Coca-Cola bottling versus their bottling companies, which sets out the way that you deal with these matters. You weigh them up. The balance always swings in favor of the person seeking to have a fair trial, because the trial is supposed to be determined, as Jampo says, on the evidence that is revealed, not on the evidence that is concealed.
These documents have now been produced in camera and are sealed and are part of the court's record. Is that correct?
I do not know what documents have been produced, Your Honor. There is no index. There is no way for me to check whether or not a complete production has taken place. And in my history of dealings with the Remington Arms Company, I have reason to doubt that. Some documents, unknown to me, are in the possession of the court, Your Honor. That does not mean that that cures the problem. In the COVID.
Well, yes, I'm just trying to understand it. If there's been a waiver by a late objection.
Two late objections, Your Honor.
By two. Right. If it's waived, then I'm wondering why mandamus is the appropriate remedy. Could not that come up on appeal? And is there enough of a record there to show harmful error? So that the error in not finding waiver would be harmful and could be reversed through the regular process.
Well, waiver is only one argument, Your Honor, but if the question that you're asking is whether or not we have an adequate remedy by appeal.
That's my question.
Jampo particularly discloses that. It says, moreover, requiring a party to try his lawsuit, debilitated by denial of proper discovery, only to have the lawsuit rendered a certain nullity on appeal, falls well short of a remedy of appeal that is equally convenient, beneficial, and as effective as mandamus.
Well, surely we have to draw some line. There are 400 trial courts trying, we hope, 40 or 50 jury trials a year. We can't monitor every denial of discovery.
I did not.
Those documents.
Do not ask
so how,
the court to do
how
that.
Do we? How do we draw a line?
Abuse of discretion, Your Honor. That's where the line is drawn.
But do we have to look at each case, review the documents, and decide if there's an abuse of discretion on every motion for protection that's granted?
I cannot speculate as to every motion for protection. However, when the only communication is through an ex-party secret affidavit as the trade secret privilege, when we have made a clear need, a showing of clear need, that we cannot obtain a fair trial without these documents, if these documents are the most important documents in the lawsuit that would allow us to prove defect and failure to warn, then yes, mandamus should lie, Your Honor. I am not here today to speculate on how mandamus might be reformed or done better. However, in this case, the record is so clear that an abuse of discretion has followed that the court should accept mandamus. Because if you don't, in my opinion, we're throwing Jampo out the window, we're throwing Garcia versus Peoples out the window, we're throwing Barnes versus Whittington out the window. I point out to the court that
let me ask you about Jampo. Isn't JAMPO different from this case because in JAMPO there was no in-camera inspection, the documents were not made part of the record, and they are made part of the record here? Isn't that what distinguishes this case from JAMPO?
I do not see that as a distinguishing point, Your Honor. Again, I suppose if you're asking whether or not I have an effective remedy by appeal by that question.
Yes.
I do not see that an effective remedy for the plaintiff is to have documents as to which he is absolutely entitled, as to which a waiver has occurred, as to which the law is well set, as to which he cannot obtain a fair trial without. And even if it could, even if the documents are in camera, Your Honor, I will not have an opportunity to examine or impeach any defense witness with those documents. I will not have an opportunity to explore whether or not a complete production has taken place. I will not have an opportunity to determine what other documents may lie in Remington's file. I will not have an opportunity to use those documents with any expert witness of the plaintiff at the trial. I will not be able to cross-examine any defendant expert witness with the documents. I will be stripped for the trial of proof, of evidence that I'm absolutely entitled to, Your Honor. Now, if we are looking for a case to make a vehicle to restrict mandamus to some extent, this is not it, in my opinion, Your Honor. There is an overwhelming record for the plaintiffs here that we cannot obtain a fair trial without these documents.
Are you saying you can't make your case without these documents, or just that it's your hope that it will make a strong case even stronger?
I have a case right now, Your Honor. I do have a case right now. But it's not for me to weigh the evidence. My job as the lawyer representing the injured man here, Louise Chaka, is to assemble all of the evidence and to bring it into the court. What Remington did here, they produced Chapter 1 of the book for us, which is the Operations Committee leading up to 1981. They admit we're entitled to that now. But then they draw a line, 1981 or 1982, and say, whoa, conceal everything after that date. Well, the evidence after that date is crucial to my cause, because really what they did, Your Honor, after that date, and the records reflect this, is that on February the 11th of 1981, they doubled the budget for research into the Model 700 fire control improvements. And then some 9 months after that, apparently, they changed the name to NBAR and said I could not discover it anymore. So just as I'm closing the trail here, Your Honor, getting the evidence, which nails the coffin shut, they slam the door in my face and say, well, you're only entitled to read Chapter 1 of the book. We're going to close the rest of it in your face. That's what's happened in this case, Your Honor.
Can you suggest a principle, however, that would limit review of discovery rulings which denied evidence to discovering part?
Well, in this case, the principle is simple. It's a Rule 166b4 waiver. And that ends the inquiry right there.
But we have to mandamus every time there's been a waiver, and the trial judge doesn't recognize it.
Counsel, we're being increasingly called upon to engage in micromanagement of the trial courts, and we're trying to determine a standard by which we can carry out our responsibility and yet at the same time not spend all of our time hearing mandamus.
I see the court's dilemma, and I appreciate the shoes that you stand in, Your Honor. But I stand here today on a singular place for my client in which the abuse of discretion is overwhelming, in which I cannot obtain a fair trial without this evidence, which is the very reason why mandamus exists in the state of Texas. We are not here on a fringe case today. This is not an appropriate case, in my opinion.
Mandamus is not available for the sole purpose of obtaining a fair trial.
I understand that. The two criteria are abuse of discretion, which I have proved by direct violation of the JAMPO rulings and by direct denial of overwhelming relevant evidence, and that I have no remedy on appeal, which I do not. No effective remedy on appeal. So I have set aside, on behalf of my client, the two criteria for mandamus in this case, Your Honor.
But no effective remedy on appeal is that you don't know that these documents are all the documents. So you don't know if an appellate court reviewing these documents you haven't seen would have a full record to work from, and that you have to go through a useless trial.
No, sir.
But that seems to me true in any case.
No, sir. In
where
this
there's
case,
a denial of production.
In this case, I know from looking at this document that we have, we've got a drawing of Model 700 fire control here. I know that features found on this gun have been eliminated. Pre-fit engagement and over travel eliminates these two screws here, which are problems, eliminates this mounting steel trigger and sear. These are powdered metal. Here's a thing called a trigger connector. I know that it's not probably built because the feature found here, this part of the thing is gone. I know that there is evidence concealed in this case which will probably, absolutely, allow me to establish defect in design and failure to warn. That's what I know in this case, and that's what we know the evidence is, Your Honor. We know that features in this design have been abandoned. We know that Remington has had problems with this design for many years. We know that a waiver occurred. We know that the documents were described. We took the deposition, for instance, which is part of the record here, of Mr. Coleman, which is another strange happening in this case. I asked the judge to compel him to answer questions concerning replacement designs. On January the 26th of 1990, the judge entered an order, said, Mr. Coleman, answer all the questions on replacement designs. 5 days later, Remington filed a motion to clarify that, in which the judge, without hearing or notice, changed the order to say that I could not inquire as to replacement designs. I then took this man's deposition, the chief of research. He refused to answer over 20 questions comparing the old design and problems with it and new features they had developed. So I have already been irrevocably prejudiced by my inability to examine their own research department concerning changes in alternative feasible designs in this case, Your Honor. There's no question in this case what has happened. I respect and appreciate the court's dilemma with the mandamus ruling. But the standards for mandamus are clear: abuse of discretion and no effective remedy by appeal. And those two things are unequivocally and unquestionably satisfied in this case, and certainly along the lines set forth by JAMPO. So there is no doubt in my mind, Your Honor, this is not a vehicle. If you're looking for a fringe vehicle or something to reform or limit mandamus, this is not the case by which it should come.
Judge Garcia's order of July the 23rd indicates that he's determined that the exhibit to the motion to compel does not present a proper request for documents under the rules.
Well, Judge, we had two exhibits. The first exhibit we filed on October the 7th of 1990 was a reproduction of our request for production filed in 1987. We then, through subsequent deposition, learned of more detailed things, and we filed another exhibit which exactly spelled out the in-bar stuff. But I will say this. By the day he made that finding, Your Honor, he had the documents in his possession, according to him, and already reviewed them. So I do not see, it appears to be more of a cover-your-flank type finding. It really has nothing to do whatsoever with the lawsuit, since he had the documents in their possession. And since the motion itself particularly described the in-bar documents which we were seeking, Your Honor. So I really do not see that that ruling has anything to do with what we're here with today, Your Honor. It's just some sort of throw-in by the trial judge after he had clearly abused his discretion in an attempt to cover himself. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Lee Ware will present argument for the
May it please the court, I'm joined here today with co-counsel, Mr. Paul Stallings. My partner is in trial in Houston. He could not be here. Judge Kilgarlin is helping me on the case. Mr. David DeMars from Corpus Christi at counsel table is the lead counsel in the trial court. Ms. Eileen O'Neill from my firm is the lawyer that's primarily responsible for the briefing on the CHAPA case. My plan is to make essentially three arguments for the court. I'm variable as to the order of those arguments and would be more than happy to take into consideration the order in which the court would like me to take them up. I'm going to make an argument that the writ of mandamus should not issue in this case, and included within that will be some principles that I derive from the 25 decisions that this court has made since 1983 involving discovery and mandamus, by which this court can eliminate some of the mandamus decisions that it has had to reach or has felt it's had to reach in the past. Second, I'm going to make an argument to the effect that this case is not Jampol versus Touche and is not controlled by Jampol versus Touche. Third, I'll make the argument, the briefest of the three, that the case is not controlled by Garcia versus Peoples.
I'd like to center in on Jampol, if that won't disrupt your order too much.
Causes no difficulty to me.
Are you seeking to restrict Jampol to alternative designs that are reflected in products that have been marketed?
I don't think the Jampol is restricted to that. I think that that was the case in Jampol. In Jampol, the prototypes and the products were there. The important thing about Jampol, insofar as we are concerned, is that we are not here saying that two products are so dissimilar that that means that one is irrelevant or can't be discoverable on some basis, which was the basis that GM was resisting discovery in Jampol. We are here in this court primarily because of a claim of privilege. And the privileges exist in 166B3E. It's recognized by Rule 507 of the Rule of Evidence. So that's the first basis for distinguishing Jampol from this case. This court can rule on behalf of Remington in this case and not do a thing to Jampol, Your Honor.
So it's not your contention that the documents being sought aren't discoverable under Jampol. It's that you have a privilege, even though they may be theoretically discoverable, your privilege counters that right to discover.
That's right, Your Honor. It's an exemption.
So we really don't need to look at whether this is a prototype or in production. It's the privilege that we need first.
This court doesn't need to look at that except for the fact that those were the basic facts of Jampol. That was what was before the court there. And in interpreting Jampol, you have to understand that. But in terms of the principle of law that this court can lay down if it so wished to, or the principle of law that controls in this case, that's not it.
All right. And with regard to, in short, as far as Jampol is concerned, you agree the language of Jampol is broad enough to encompass this discovery involved in this case.
The Honor, Jampol leaves open, does not address the issue of whether or not you get to get into trade secrets, into ongoing research of products that have not been developed. That was not the case in Jampol. So it neither precludes this court nor helps this court on that fact.
With regard to your trade secret allegation, it is, I believe in the judge's order, that the trade secret here is of such significance and the danger to Remington of disclosure so great that no discovery can be permitted at all, and the protective order denies the discovery altogether. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, and the basis for that, of course, is that there never was a need shown by the plaintiffs in this case to get this material. You have to understand that whatever is shown to this court here, over here, the only document that was ever shown to the court in any of the hearings had to do was the May 31, 1985 business team minute.
Well, with regard to the use of a protective order to completely deny discovery because of a trade secret, is there any authority for that in Texas? Got any cases where a trial judge action in completely denying discovery in order to protect the trade secret has been approved?
The only authority of that I'm aware of, Your Honor, is the authority that exists in the rule itself in subdivision one of that aspect.
No case authority interpreting that.
I'm not aware of any.
Do you have any authority for doing that anywhere in the United States?
Yes, Your Honor. There are cases where the discovery has been denied.
Is that in your brief?
Yes, sir. Now let me say one thing, that there is a clear delineation in Rule 166 that says that a trial court may order that the discovery not be sought in whole or in part. Our position here, however, is that the balancing that has to take place could never actually occur in this case because there was never a need shown for the material.
All right, and that's because you say that the only need shown were the charts that we just had presented. Is that right?
Well, that's not evidence of need either, but
that's what was
the purpose of that is to merely point out to the court that that's not before the trial court.
And do I understand, so that I know everything before the trial court, that the only evidence that you had to support your privilege was this secret affidavit of Mr. Coleman?
No, sir. We're directly within the holding of the Wiesel opinion, the per curiam opinion, that says that the documents themselves, when you claim an exemption or a privilege, are the evidence that the court must review. The court did exactly what it must do. The court went on, the trial court went on, and assuming that this court wants to reach the issue of protective order, makes the basis that the protective order that can protect them in this instance is the protective order of no discovery because there's been no showing of need.
Right. And the protective order of no discovery, there are no Texas cases interpreting that, but you say there are some United States, some cases in the United States.
There are federal cases that certainly do that, Your Honor.
Those are referred to in the brief you've
filed. Yes, sir. I believe they are.
All right. And
if they're not, I'll certainly, by way of letter brief or however it would be appropriate to supplement that, provide the court with the cases that have looked at the issue.
That would be helpful. And
right.
And so the documents themselves, the file cabinet has been sent up to us, and Mr. Coleman's affidavit are it as far as evidence.
Yes, sir. Mr. Coleman's affidavit, of course, is problematic. It demonstrates primarily that I can try to secrete something in the hallowed, ironclad halls of Vincent Elkins when I have an interest of keeping it secret and can't even get it done under that instance. The secret affidavit, the actual interchange that took place there was they told me we need to have an affidavit, secret affidavit, and I said that doesn't sound right, and they said Judge Mosey did not say that you couldn't do it. I said, okay, show me that opinion. Judge Mosley didn't say you couldn't, that you couldn't do it. And I said, you know, the reason he's not telling us that we can't do it is because he thinks that there are some things we're going to figure out on our own. So it was a goofy idea to begin with.
You say you were told to submit a secret affidavit?
I'm sorry?
You were told to submit a secret affidavit?
No.
Okay.
No. But when I say they, I'm talking about the associates that were working on the brief.
All right. I see.
Okay. No, we were not told by the court or anybody to submit a secret affidavit. And it was a goofy idea to begin with.
Well, why do you say that, I want to get to their waiver argument at some point, but first, why do you say that they made no showing that they need these documents? Under 507, I see a balancing test. You can't conceal fraud by
right.
withholding trade secrets, and you can't otherwise work an injustice.
That's right.
So let's just work on the can't otherwise work an injustice.
Which is, I think, the one that applies.
Why didn't their showing of these documents, they have big blow-ups of them, we have, I assume you have a copy of it, why doesn't that show that this information would be helpful in understanding in making a case out of a design defect?
The test that's contemplated there is the test that's utilized in federal courts, and that is once you claim the exemption, somebody comes in and they say, we can't get it otherwise, and it's necessary.
Well, I assume they can't get it otherwise.
They can, Your Honor. There are about 3,000 bolt-action fire controls out there, and there are, in addition to that, experts on firearms design. They have employed them. Their experts take the position in depositions. We don't need the Remington documents. We know all we need to know. They've not shown an expert who says, I need to have, like in Jampol, says, I need to have that information to render
an
opinion.
In other words, if you can make the case, if you can get to the jury,
they get to the jury
with a substantially strong case without the documents, then it works no injustice.
That's right.
Make an absolute sealing of all those documents in order to protect the trade.
What that does is that gets the trial, that gets you straight into the bailiwick where the trial court has discretion. He has to do the balancing. This trial court has exhibited his willingness to do the balancing had somebody shown him some need. Given no presentation of need, the balancing almost necessarily comes out to preclude discovery.
Now, why didn't... what's wrong with their argument that they asked for these documents, they asked for it with the magic word early, and you made no response to the documents?
And
you don't have to ask that many times in order to get it, and so that all this is too late anyway.
Request number 71 asked for alternate designs having to do with the fire control on the model 721, the 722, the 725, the model 700, and the model 788, and they got all of those. And the fact that there is a document 5 years after the date of manufacture of this rifle where Remington is looking at replacing the rifle is not a document that relates to an alternate design of a fire control or a safety, which is what the request was.
They didn't use the word improvement?
Yeah, I'm sorry?
They didn't use the word, I believe.
I'm not sure what the specific language of request number 71 is, but it certainly is in the record. And if the court looks at that, a fair reading of that request is they are looking for changes that have been made to the models, to any one of those rifles actually made to the fire controls. In fact, not only is that a fair reading of it, it is a stretching reading to get to the conclusion that Mr. Chapman gets to, and it is not a reasonable reading to get to his conclusion.
I understood him to say, referring to Groucho Marx, that he used the word replacement.
I think that they do use the word replacement in terms of limited to the fire controls for those five specific rifles.
Doesn't Mr. Coleman's affidavit refer to this as a replacement or alternatively featured bolt-action centerfire rifle on page 2?
That's right. There's a difference between asking for improvements, replacements, or alternates that have to do with fire controls of five specific rifles and making a request for ongoing research into a replacement rifle. Replacing a fire control or asking about improvements or changes to a fire control does not get you to where I'm going to cough up documents that have to do with replacement for the entire rifle.
Well, these index documents look like they're just replacing portions of the 700. Is that wrong? I mean,
which document are you referring to, Your Honor?
Well, here's one that's Exhibit 13, replacement brooch for an M700.
Surely the rifle is some of its parts, isn't it?
A rifle, of course, is the sum of its parts, Your Honor.
And you weren't testing, as Mr. Coleman's affidavit seems to indicate,
not always a whole rifle. You would test individual parts like fire control.
Certainly, Your Honor.
So why wasn't that information weighed when you didn't supply it?
Because, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
On the specific request for production concerning replacement.
Because the replacement has to do with a specific part of an existing rifle, the Model 700, or one of the other four rifles that all exist. It's limited by that. When we get to the point where if somebody wants to know about are you looking at any or doing any ongoing research that has to do with replacing the entire rifle or replacing, for that matter, a specific part of an existing rifle, anything ongoing, the way you designate that with particularity is say, I want to look at your ongoing research. When they say that, I object. When they did say that, in October, about a year ago, in 1989, when Mr. Chapman was down in the valley saying he was ready to go to trial without these documents, when they did say that, we did object.
Your position is that when they asked for replacements on the Model 700 rifle, but they didn't specify ongoing research, that that wasn't with sufficient particularity?
No, sir. When the request number 71 goes to improvements that have been made in a specific part of existing rifles. It does not get to, nor does it reach, on research 5 years after the date of manufacture and 10 years, 5 years after the date of the accident and 10 years after the date of manufacture, in which they're looking at replacing an entire rifle. And of course, the way that they do that, I can't deny, and it is obviously true, that the way they do that is that they test individual parts. There was no intent exhibited in the documents to take specific tested items out of the NBAR program. That was not the purpose of the NBAR program, to improve the Model 700, and that was the finding of the trial court based upon a factual evidentiary inquiry. And when we get into this here, we are engaged in supervising the details of discovery at about as low a level as we can get into it.
Tell us about your argument on the remedy of that.
Yes, sir. Since 1983, which I want to go back to the Lawrence versus General Motors because it's in the concurring opinion there that Justice Ray forecast Jampol, this court has written, I think, 24 times on mandamus and discovery matters. The difficulty with that is that I immediately note that on 21 out of the 24 instances the writ has issued, the three times that it is not issued because somebody waived it. So I understand that there is a hurdle to begin with when this court grants leave to file, because the numbers are against me. Let me suggest that if you go back to Lawrence versus General Motors and read the cases from that date to the last two that Justice Gonzalez wrote for the court last week, three rules emerge that will take this court or give it some basis for limiting discovery supervision in trial courts. One, the first rule, is a rule that applies to an improper denial of discovery. No mandamus issues in such a case except when there is not a complete record. This is the Jampol case. That is what Jampol does control vis-a-vis the availability of mandamus. This is also Justice Gonzalez's opinions in Axelson and Scott last week, where a trial court would not let them take depositions of witnesses because they've been designated as consulting experts. Let me stress the rule. Improper denial of discovery by a trial court, no mandamus issues in any case except in an instance where there's a procedural glitch of an incomplete record. Second rule, improper granting of discovery, a rule applying to the improper granting of discovery. The rule should be, or the rule that derives from the cases is, there's no mandamus except in cases involving a claim of privilege, exemption, or constitutional right. The problem here is a substantive right. The issue is ripe for this court's determination upon the claim of privilege. Once it is denied, once the discovery is granted, this court has to act to preserve the substance of the appeal because the privilege, the exemption, or the constitutional right, once it's out in the open, or once it's released, your substantive right disappears. In this instance, nothing is added by completing the record, by letting this court function as it was intended to function, as a complete, as an appellate type of court.
So the second rule is that if the discovery is granted over a claim of privilege, we need to review it. But if the converse happens, we ought not to review it.
If it's denied, you can take care of it on appeal.
This is West versus Toledo type of case.
Yes. It's also cases that involve client privilege and things of that sort. It's also this case, Your Honor.
Restated another way, then, the rule should be that mandamus is available to obstruct discovery, but not to encourage it.
No, sir. That should not be the rule. I full well understand that Justice Spears, to the extent that he participates, and I'm beginning to sense that Your Honor may feel this way, that I'm not going to get to argue that we get to obstruct discovery. The position is that in an instance where there is an improper use made of a privilege, Rule 3 applies. These are cases where Justice Gonzalez has written, I think Justice Mossie has written, in these cases where somebody has tried to present a claim and obstruct discovery upon the claim by saying, by the way, I have a privilege there, and therefore you can't go get the medical records or whatever. Rule 3 is the third rule, and it's the rule simply to the effect, it's a rule that applies whenever there is a granting or a denying of discovery on a basis or in a manner not authorized by the rules. Mandamus issues, in this instance, under this court's supervisory powers. A trial judge does not have discretion to deviate from the rules in either the manner or the basis for providing for discovery. If he does so, then this court has an interest in making the trial court follow the rule, and this is akin to an instance in which this court will grant mandamus to vacate or to take care of a void order. To the extent that he exceeds his authority or he deviates from his authority, as prescribed by the rules.
Three swallows up the whole rule, doesn't it?
I'm sorry?
Unless I misheard you, three just says if the judge abuses his or her discretion.
This doesn't.
The first two,
the mandamus lies because in certain instances the appeal is not active. Your concern is that Rule 3 swallows all of the rest of them.
Rule 3 gets us into the situation where we review every ruling a trial judge makes on discovery in order to determine whether there's an abuse of discretion. Does it not? And maybe that is the rule. But no, sir. But I missed it if it's more limited.
It gets you to the position where when there is an allegation that the trial court has not done what the trial court is required by rule to do or whatever. Rule 3 is the third rule, and it's the rule simply to the effect that it's a rule that applies whenever there is a granting or a denying of discovery on a basis or in a manner not authorized by the rules. Mandamus issues, in this instance, under this court's supervisory powers. A trial judge does not have discretion to deviate from the rules in either the manner or the basis for providing for discovery. If he does so, then this court has an interest in making the trial court follow the rule, and this is akin to an instance in which this court will grant mandamus to vacate or to take care of a void order. To the extent that he exceeds his authority or he deviates from his authority, as prescribed by the rules.
Three swallows up the whole rule, doesn't it?
I'm sorry?
Unless I misheard you, three just says if the judge abuses his or her discretion.
This doesn't.
The first two,
the mandamus lies because in certain instances the appeal is not active. Your concern is that Rule 3 swallows all of the rest of them.
Rule 3 gets us into the situation where we review every ruling a trial judge makes on discovery in order to determine whether there's an abuse of discretion. Does it not? And maybe that is the rule. But I missed it if it's more limited.
It gets you to the position where when there is an allegation that the trial court has not done what the trial court is required by rule to do, or has done something that is not permitted by the rule, then you have to review. This gets you into cases such as Mutter versus Woods, where Judge Woods required them to sign the medical authorization. It gets them Justice Doggett into Masinga, where you concurred with Judge Spears on the videotape depositions. It gets you to Flores. That's Justice Mossie. That has to do with the use of the limitation on an investigation privilege, and the comp case is one of Justice Mossie's concerns. It gets you to Coates, and it gets you, unfortunately, to Lofton. The difficulty that is presented here, and the reason why this is not much of a rule of limitation, number three, is because in number three, to the extent that this court increasingly prescribes conduct that must be taken by the trial court in resolving discovery disputes, you necessarily are going to increase the number of instances in which mandamus review is going to have to lie under your supervisory powers. I can't affect the rules of discovery. Discovery in Texas is broken, and there do need to be new rules. And if you want to get completely shut of Rule 3, type cases, or if you want to seriously reduce them, the only way you can do that, of course, is to grant greater discretion and less supervision by way of the rules. And there's nothing I can do about that, Your Honor.
I can't limit much there.
Are
you saying if it's broken, it's because we grant too many and not because the scope of the mandamus power?
It's broken because of Rule 4, which unfortunately does not arise in this case, and Rule 4 applies to death sentence cases where the defendant has to go through a trial without any pleadings on a default judgment. In that particular instance, once you look at that particular instance, it becomes clear that we have done a complete role reversal with respect to this court and the trial courts. This court is now the final arbiter on discovery matters, and trial courts are in actuality the final arbiter on the merits of the case. Precisely the reverse of what ought to be the instance, Your Honor.
Can you speak just a moment to the argument that this waiver again with regards to your evidence? You never raised trade secrets until pretty late in the game.
We didn't raise trade secrets until we knew that they were looking for NBAR. Their request that was some months before they knew the existence of NBAR was not calculated to get to NBAR in our reading of that request. If the court moves in this area where you get to the point that you are supervising not only the way that a trial court will accept a lawyer's reading of a discovery request, that is involvement in the minutia of discovery at about the lowest level that it gets to, because that's the material that the day-to-day discovery dispute is about. One lawyer reads it one way, another lawyer reads it another way. Rule 4, Your Honor, not here because the court improvidently granted the writ in Craig versus Remington. Rule 4 should be a rule that mandamus issues to take care of a defendant whose pleadings are stricken, because that is essentially an order of execution, and you shouldn't have to undergo the execution before you have some type of appellate relief. With those four rules...
Why couldn't that be? I mean, it's not on the case, but why can't that be handled by appeal very simply?
Because you will never see that appeal. Because a responsible lawyer in the face of Justice Ray's decision, or the court's decision in Coslow's, is not going to tell a solvent defendant, go down and take the death sentence because I'll prevail on some principle at some future date. That case is going to get settled, or something's going to happen to it, and that's the reason why this court doesn't see those cases in very many instances. That's the reason why it comes up in a sworn account case vis-a-vis a plaintiff's pleadings being stricken. Of course, plaintiff's pleadings, if they're stricken, they get immediate appellate review because of the nature of the sanction. That case, to the extent that this court makes a claim that we don't ever get the really messed up cases, that's a case that is so messed up that it's not going to get here in most instances. And there is no meaningful appellate review when you have to go suffer a ruinous judgment and then supersede that judgment under our rules. Final point.
I don't believe we've had a submission yet this fall without a mandamus, Molly.
And
under these rules, I'm not sure we're going.
There will always be a mandamus in that case, but there will seldom be an appeal, because mandamus is the only hope you hold out to the client in that instance. Garcia does not control the case because Garcia dealt with whether or not a protective order was sufficient or what the grounds or basis of a protective order would be. We have filed a supplemental brief having to do with Rule 76A. We accept Rule 76A as a law, and I'm not here to argue. Justice Doggett is smiling. I've known Justice Doggett since we were high school debaters. He may not remember this. It is significant and predictable somewhat, and I may say this without being too familiar, that what finally gets him to come out and write on discovery involves TV cameras. But in any event, we're not questioning Rule 76A, Your Honor. And that's just not the issue here, Judge Hector or Judge Gonzalez.
You did request an opportunity to make a 76A argument to the trial court.
Yes, sir. Rule 76A, when we were in the trial court, Rule 76A was not the law.
I understand.
What we're saying here is that Garcia versus Peoples is largely irrelevant in view of 76A because we can't get a protective order. In Jampol, it's also significant, if I may hitchhike for 1 second on that, but in Jampol, GM admitted that a protective order would protect them. We're making no such admission here. Finally, The factual determinations on this case are that Mr. Chapman and his client, because of their conduct in discovery and because of their conduct in discovery on purloining documents and stealing photographs, come in with unclean hands vis-a-vis the remedy. And therefore, that's another basis
for it. Is there a record that you made on that in the trial court in any one place? How is that before?
The record was made on that, Your Honor, and Judge Garcia's reply to that was something to the effect of, given that all of that is true, what do you want me to do, slap his wrists? And the problem, of course, is that once it's done, it's done. And that's the reason why the protective order does not suffice.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
If I may, Your Honor, Mr. Stallings, this Justice Ray, this last probably the last time we're going to get to argue in front of him, he said to be sure and thank you, sir, for your service on the bench. The
court is ready to hear rebuttal arguments.
I trust you'll be living and pleading those decisions with us.
Yes, sir. Rule to the court. I want to lay only one way to read it.
I agree with that. That's counsel's own words. Request number 71. All documents or correspondence of any sort regarding the place of any part of the fire control system of Model 700 or a whole series of others. Now, we named it Ron DeBell, as I said before, won the prize in the old Groucho Marx show. How can you say this in a way? Richmond says, here's what you have to do. You can't ask for the new bolt action rifle, but that's not good enough. No, this program is known as NBAR, new bolt action rifle. So not only to get the documents from Remington, do you have to guess the name new bolt action rifle, you have to guess the name NBAR, the acronym. Pretty tough guess. We called the shot, we named it, we hit it square on, the waiver occurred, there's no way around it. Unless this court wants to throw out Hobson, Peoples, Rule 167C, there is no other finding that can come down there, Your Honor. I want to read for you a few quotes from other courts. Quote, Remington has acted in bad faith and abused the discovery process. Close quote. Quote, Remington is found in contempt for failing to comply with the court's order. Close
shouldn't
quote.
We really judge this case?
Sir?
Shouldn't we really be judging this case?
Except for one thing. The conduct or the pattern of a party's discovery conduct should be considered. If there is a pattern of abuse shown, which we have shown it here with 5 or 6 sanctions orders, 4 within the last year and a half. Rule of Evidence 407 specifically speaks to conduct or patterns of conduct, and that is what we are dealing with here, a pattern of conduct.
Are these quotes you're reading us from trial court orders? Or
yes, sir. Trial court orders attached as copies with our brief, Your Honor.
All right, and so they are part of your brief?
Yes, sir.
And are there any that are reflected in published appellate opinions?
Published appellate opinions? I do not know that, Your Honor. I have not seen any. But dealing with published opinions, counsel says there are cases where documents have been denied. I say that's not so. There is no case reported in the United States jurisprudence where a personal injury plaintiff in a products liability case was denied access to relevant documents claimed as trade secrets in this type of case. No case reported whatsoever.
Well, he says he's going to supplement on that, and of course you'll have an opportunity to reply to whatever he supplements.
He said it was in his brief, and I deny that, Your Honor. It is not, because there is no case. This court would become the first court in the nation to have such a holding. I urge this court not to be led down that path.
Let me ask you to focus on his argument that the trial court did not abuse its discretion because you did not establish good cause for getting this discovery.
Well, Your Honor, I submitted, unlike what counsel says, 2 depositions of the chief of research, Mr. Coleman, in which this subject is discussed for several hundred pages. I appeared 3 times and I argued to the court. I said that the man testified that this is going to be called, we all watch TV, this is going to be called the new, this is his testimony, the new improved Model 700. That's what it's going to be called. That's what his testimony, good choice. The fire control they're working on fits into the Model 700. It's retrofittable. It's actually been tested.
As far as the evidence that the trial judge had considered then, you say that in addition to, this exhibit right here?
He recites in his order that he read both the Coleman depositions, Your Honor. And I mailed him, prior to the signing of his written order, all the documents which the court has here today. And he recites he reviewed the pleadings of the parties.
So all these blow-ups that we will have available to look at, some more that you've referred to, all of those were available at the time
yes,
of the court act?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. West v. Toledo has nothing to do with this case. West v. Toledo said that you cannot review factual matters for the first time on mandamus. There is no suggestion that we ask you to do that. Lawrence v. GM, they asked for every document produced from GM from 1909 to the future of every model vehicle GM had ever made. That doesn't apply to this case, because we only want the things dealing with the Model 700 and its replacements. Neither one of those cases have anything to do with this mandamus proceeding, Your Honor.
Are the Coleman depositions that the trial judge had an opportunity to review a part of the record that is before us?
Yes, sir.
Are they up here?
They have been tendered as part of the record, Your Honor.
But it is your position that no matter what you call it, if the product that is being researched and developed by Remington has anything to do with the model that preceded, whether it's new, replacement, redesign, redevelop, just throw the old one away and we're going to, or keep the old one and we're going to market this one too, no matter what, which one of those boxes it falls into, you get it.
I don't see how. I mean, look at the invitation you would be making, Your Honor. You would say, well, anytime a product manufacturer gets in trouble with the product, just change the name, and then you can't discover it. What type of precedent is that?
I think your answer is yes.
The answer is yes. To close this, Your Honor, Remington has speculated and conjectured, had a goofy idea according to their own counsel. They do have a fear in this case. But the fear, Your Honors, is not that these documents will fall into the hands of their competitors, for there is no evidence of that. The fear is that these documents will fall into the hands of 12 angry jurors in Duval County and across this country, Your Honor. We ask that Remington be our
witness. Your time has expired, counsel. That completes the argument in the first cause. The court will take a brief recess.
You used to be.